Accession number 16703, Rena Quint, reel 3, followed by final reel 4, after a pause. I think this is actually, in effect, a mono recording.
Rena Quint, reel 3. Yes, you were saying about...
I was saying that we were picked up after seeing the Statue of Liberty and after everybody going up on the deck and the excitement, and we saw all those people waiting. And, of course, Anna and Sigmund and I didn't know who was going to pick us up, but I think there were signs there. And when we found these people, they brought us to a place in Brooklyn, and they lived in this very large house, 6 floors up and lots of windows, and I thought, my goodness, one family lives in a house like that. Afterwards, I found out that many families, and it was a flat that they only had, but even then it was big in comparison to what I had. But my first impression that, I mean, this must have been a palace of palaces, and it wasn't. It was just a normal kind of thing. And we came there, and then they brought us to a family in Lindenhurst, Long Island. And after staying in their house for a few days, they had gotten an apartment. And Anna and Sigmund, by that time his name was changed to Stanley. And my name was changed to Francis from Fanny. I don't know why Francis was better than Fanny.
What was your surname then?
Well, I was born with the name of Lichtenstein, Freja Lichtenstein. And the Yiddish name was Fredel, which I was probably called. And then someplace there, after that, I had gotten a boy's name. And then in Sweden, I got the name Fanny. And then in the United States, I got the name Francis. And
what was your Fredel surname?
Lichtenstein.
Oh, you were still called Lichtenstein?
No.
But when you were Francis?
When I was Francis, it was Philip Stahl. Philip Stahl. Philistahl, because that was the name of this little girl and her mother and her brother. And I was registered in a school. I was first put into a first grade, but I was so much bigger than they were. I guess in contrast, I used to be the smallest, so now I was the biggest. But they realized that maybe I was a little smarter than the 6-year-old, so they put me into a higher class. And this was already April, and I wasn't there for very long, maybe about May, and then school ended. And I remember the street over there, and I had gotten a doll carriage and a doll. By that time, I was really a big girl for that, but I was delighted to have gotten these things. And we had chicken, and we had chicken soup, and we had all these different things every Friday night. And I remember sometimes feeling we already have that. And now looking back at it, how could you say that after not having it for so many years? But somehow or other you get used to good things very quickly. And she made an apartment for us, and I went to school. And the children were very good to me. They would take me, and I was the only new child. Stanley had gone into a high school. He had school before the war. And they taught me in saying, say tree, this is a tree. And say house, this is a hat. And I believed, again, the normal and the abnormal. I got to believing that every day a new word is born. And when you learn the word chair, everybody uses that word. Everybody says sit on the chair, move the chair, do the chair. And that was the new word for the day. A new word was born. And the next day I would learn another word. I remember one day I learned the word etc. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the new word for the day. And since I didn't speak any other language, really, I learned English very quickly. But then the summer came, and we were taken to a bungalow colony out in the mountains. And that we had one room for us. And very, very shortly after that, there was a communal kitchen where people used to cook together. And one day, I got up in the morning, and I was told that Anna was sick, and she was taken back to Lindenhurst. And I was left there with Stanley, Sigmund, and I, and the people around there took care of us. By this time, we were also big already. There was a day camp there. There was a swimming pool. There were cows there. And then a few days after that, and I was just running around having a good time playing the way a child would in camp. Some people came, including this family who had brought us over, very somber, very sad, and they said to get dressed and to take some things along, and we were going back into the city. And nobody told me why. They really felt that I wasn't old enough. I was a child. All of a sudden, I got back to being a child. But everybody was crying. And we got there, and there was, what I learned afterwards, was a funeral. I had never seen a funeral. I had seen a lot of dead bodies and a lot of dead people, but that was acceptable, and they were just piled up. And here there was one person who was put into a box, and they made a big hole in the ground, and everybody was crying. And I didn't understand why. And they just never told me. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me what was happening, and that Anna had died. And again, coming back to the normal of abnormal, this was abnormal. This was really abnormal. And I guess looking back again, also, psychologists would say before you take a child to a funeral, you should explain to them. But they figured either that I wouldn't understand or that I was so sophisticated with death that I could accept it. It was very traumatic. And I don't remember crying. I just remember being very bewildered, but everybody else was crying. And then we were taken back, and we sat in this family that had brought us over. We sat Shiva, which is a Jewish mourning period of 7 days. And then Stanley and I were going to go back to the apartment. But then there was a lot of talk about it, and the family that brought us over really was not ready to take on another mouth to feed, and two children couldn't live by themselves in an apartment. So they asked me if I wanted to visit somebody in Brooklyn, New York, by the name of Jacob and Mia Globe. And of course, I went, and that really started the beginning of my new life. I went there for a weekend, and they asked if I'd like to live there. My answer was yes. I don't know why they asked. I mean, you know, it's not as if I could have gotten there or left by myself. And they put me into a public school. By that time, I was put into the third grade. So I was getting closer to my age. This was after the summer. And I had some very traumatic experiences in the United States in school, more so than I remember from the camps. I guess because when you're living a normal life, you are allowed to feel, whereas when you're in camps, you just go along and without feeling. And what happened was that I came into the school had already started, and there was a little boy, Benjamin, who walked me to school, because I wouldn't have known how to get there and back. And he was in my class, and he was very smart, and the teacher had given a spelling test. I didn't know how to spell. I didn't even know the words. And apparently I was looking around, and her name was Mrs. Dutney. She was not Jewish. She had no experience with anybody who had come from concentration camp. And she pulled me out because she thought I was cheating. I didn't know what I had done wrong, but I knew that I had done something terrible. And she brought me to the principal, and she was yelling. And the principal sort of let her go out and kept me in the office. And called my parents in, and the next day I was put into the fourth grade. I was promoted rather than demoted, because he figured that this teacher really did not have the personality that could accept this odd child who didn't belong in the class. And I was put into the fourth grade with Mrs. McKinney. I remember her name very well. Again, somebody who had no experience with this. And during a music period, we all went into a big auditorium, and they were playing Country Gardens. I remember the music there. And again, I was looking around because I didn't know what was expected of me. And again, I was pulled out for doing something wrong. I just didn't follow orders. But I didn't know what I was doing wrong either. Anyway, my parents came and they decided this was not a place for me. I needed something more private and special. And they put me into a Jewish day school where there were only 11 children in the class and explained the situation. And there they treated me like somebody a little bit different. And again, the children were taught me English, and I learned Jewish subjects as well as, because I hadn't in the other school, it was a public school. And I learned English very quickly. I mean, people now tell me that I speak English like an American, but of course it's because I didn't know any other language probably well. So it's not that I could have acquired an accent. And one of the things that I remember was there was a film being shown called My Father's House by Maya Levitt. And again, the teachers and my adopted parents felt that I should be shielded and I could not be taken to see a movie about the war years. So instead, I was taken to see Pinocchio, and they were there. So people tried very much to keep out, and really nobody ever talked about the war. Nobody questioned me, and nobody made any references, although I'm sure the whole neighborhood must have known that this new child came into the neighborhood, but nobody approached it. This is a taboo subject. Mm.
Would you have liked to have spoken about it to these
people? I don't think so. I wanted very much to be accepted. I wanted very much to be liked. I didn't want anybody to know that I was sick, because if I was sick and if they would have known that, would they be willing to sit next to me and to play with me? So I really didn't want them to know, and I wanted to ride a bicycle, and I wanted to play with a doll, and I wanted to run. And I remember one day there was a girl, Rita was her name, and she had blonde hair, and she was climbing up on a monkey bar, and her hair was blowing in the wind, and I guess I was maybe 10 and a half then at that time, I mean, probably a year afterwards. And I remember feeling, isn't it wonderful to climb on a monkey bar and to have your hair blowing in the wind and just being so free? I don't think I ever thought about that in the camp. It was just after things were fine. Why retard that monkey bar? But that was sort of saying, so wonderful to be so free. By that time, I had gotten private lessons. I was far behind, and I was not the best one in the school. Every time they would have this reading competition, I came in last, because the reading competition is how fast you could read. But every year, I got a little bit better, and by the time I finished high school, I finished high school in 3 years instead of 4 years, and then I finished college in 3.5 years instead of 4 years. So by the time I graduated, I was in the right class level, and I did all the things American children did, and I never talked about it. We just never brought it up. My adopted parents had told me that they looked for my family. There was nobody to be found. They contacted a woman in Sweden, and I still have letters from her written in Polish, saying she called it with the translation that I had come from what she called an aristocratic family. I don't know whether that meant just a fine family or a rich family, or it was just her word of saying it's okay. It was nice to hear that, but I didn't really take it very seriously. Even now, I don't take it seriously because, you know, it's just a personal kind of thing. But she did not know of anybody really who stayed alive. I did meet this woman and her daughter in Haifa, in Israel, many years later. But every time we went there, we would talk a little bit about it, but every time she would see me, she would start crying, and I decided to back off, and we just didn't talk about it. She has died since. Her daughter is completely irreligious, does not believe in God, and does not ever go to a synagogue, and I am religious, and we do go to the synagogue, and we have brought up our children as Jews. And one day we went to Haifa to visit her, and her husband had been in a bad accident and had stopped working. So when we came there, he said, now that he's retired, he became active in the synagogue, and he wanted to show it to us, because since we were religious and they had been so, he wanted to show us, you know, his new lifestyle. So I said, let's go down, all to us. And when we came there, she refused to go into the synagogue. And I said, you know why? And she said, I made a deal with God when I was in Sweden. She said, God, if you help me find my father, then I'll believe you. And if you don't help me find my father, I don't want anything to do with you. And she said, he didn't help me find my father, so I will never go into a synagogue. It hurt me to feel that way, because I don't feel that way, but I suppose I can understand her point of view. Her husband has changed. Her husband now is very much involved in this because he finds he has more time. So Lucia, her name is Sarah now, she changed her name, but she and her mother came to Haifa together. She told me that she was asked by Anna first to go to America, and I was apparently second choice. She didn't want to go because she had a mother. Why she asked her if she had a mother, I don't know. But she, this is what Lucia had told me. She had a mother and she had a brother in France. Maybe they weren't together at the same time. But she wound up going to Israel and I wound up going to the United States. So I guess that's fate and destiny.
Do you think, you know, when you learned about Judaism and that you were Jewish, that you know, was sort of important for you? And particularly that, you know, the anti-Semitic.
It was very important to me, but I don't know, had I been brought up by a different family, whether it would have been just as important. But I was brought up by a family that believed in Jewish values and going to the synagogue. And then I married a man who was even more observant than I was. And it got to be very much part of our life. And now I really, as I said, you asked me before if I knew that I was Jewish in the camps, and I don't know what it meant to be Jewish, maybe. But now, looking back at it, the reason this happened to me was for no other reason except that I was Jewish. It wasn't that I was a war criminal, that I had taken somebody's land. I mean, I was a child, so it's not as if I had any, and if somebody would have asked me at that time to convert to Christianity, I don't think I would have thought twice about it. Had I been allowed to stay with a man in Sweden, I'm sure I would have, and I could have been brought up as a Christian child there. But now I feel that I want very much to be Jewish and to stay Jewish and to bring back some of the Jewish people who were taken away from us. And I feel that if I'm alive, there's no way I could be alive unless God wanted me to be alive. I mean, I didn't save myself. And I think he saved me, and I believe in that. And I don't understand why God had so many people whom he didn't save. Why did so many people die, and so many good people, and so many smart people? But I think for every person he saved, maybe there is a reason. Now, I can't tell you what the reason is. Sometimes I think it's maybe for the sake of my husband, or my children, or my grandchildren, or somebody else. I feel very, very lucky that we live in a large home and we're in a position to entertain and welcome people in. And I sort of feel every time I do something, maybe that's why. I don't know.
When did you know the full extent of the Holocaust?
Well, you know, as a teenager, as you grow up and as you read stories, and I didn't read too many of them, but I really stayed away from the topic very much, and I did not meet any Holocaust survivors, and my adoptive parents were not survivors. And 1981, there was a gathering of Holocaust survivors in Israel. And at that point, I said, you know, I'd like to go, because they said they were going to have computers, and they were going to be able to trace things. And just the way I came to the Imperial War Museum with anticipation, at that time I had gone to Israel with anticipation. And I had one daughter who was going to be getting married in Israel. She had been finishing college in New York and going to Israel. And I had another daughter who was studying there. And my son was graduating eighth grade. And this convention, this gathering, was going to take place just the day after his graduation. And I said, I really can't go, because after all, you have to go to your son's graduation. It's a very important milestone. And my children and my husband all encouraged me to go. And my son said, not only don't I mind you missing my graduation, but as a graduation present, I want to go with you. So that was sort of decided. So we all went to Israel. Actually, one of my daughters was taking regents, which is examinations. So she and my husband stayed home. But my other three children went with me, and we went to Israel. And the first day, it was like a four or five day program of every day, different lectures and different things. But the first day, we were going to go into this Binyanei HaUmah, which is like an international convention center, and they had computers, and you were able to punch in the people you were looking for. And we got up very early and went over, and I tried to find of what I remembered at that time. That was before I had gotten the records of my brother's names, what I thought I remembered. And as I said, I remembered correctly, but I wasn't quite sure of my mother's name, my father's name, and my name. I didn't remember my grandparents, aunts and uncles or cousins. And I got nothing from the computer. So we went on to the next computer and again punched everything in, nothing. And we went on looking. My children did it with me. And then we went over to the authorities to say, what are we doing wrong? Because we're not getting any of these things. And he tried, and he got nothing. And then he said, you know what? A computer only has what somebody puts into it. And if you put nothing in, because I kept on saying, if they're not here, I'm here. I know that I'm here. How can you do this? He says, did you put it in? And I said, no. So then I realized that I had just been hiding. And hiding my head in the sand and just making believe that it didn't happen. So my husband and my children, I really took a real effort to write to Arlson, which is the International Tracing Bureau. And they sent us back a letter telling me about my parents. They did not know what happened to them. Telling me about myself. And I was the only one that they seemed to have much more of a pedigree, that I had been in the ghetto, and I had been in the slave labor camp, and I had been in this camp, Chanstakhova. That's why I say I was there, even though I don't have real proof of being there, but I'm hoping to find lists of maybe. And then I have to find the right name, because I don't know under what name I was there. Because when I found my name, I found one name in Bergen-Belsen, that was, I couldn't find it under men, and I couldn't find it under women, and I couldn't find it under girls or boys, and I was ready to give up, and there was somebody who was working for me, and she says, let's not give up, let's go on, and she finally found my name under a title of Unaccompanied Children. You know, you wouldn't, why would I look under UN? I was looking under children and all that. So if I look at Chanstakhova, I also have to look at the right name and the right list. And what happens is that I start looking, and then I get so discouraged when I come to a dead end. And I say, I've got such a good life. What is going to change? And I just give up. And then something else happens, and I start again, and then I give up. But from the time of 1981, I found, and people helped me, and I found my name on a list from Sweden, which was of Jews who were liberated from German concentration camps. And then I found my list in a book called Sherit HaPleita. Although that was not easy, I found that in YIVO, which is a center in New York. And I had gone through so many places looking for lists, and every time I came in, people sort of would try to discourage me, saying that it couldn't be. When I got to YIVO, I didn't tell the librarian that I was looking for myself. I just told her I was looking for a child, because I didn't want her to tell me again that it didn't happen, that it wasn't there. And I found it. I found the name. So I had proof that I was in Bergen-Belsen, because before that, I thought it was in Bergen-Belsen, but I said, it could have been another camp. I mean, one camp wasn't any different, really, than another, as far as I was concerned. I can describe the camp, but where it was. So I found my name in Bergen-Belsen. Then in 1989, so this was 8 years apart, I went back to Pietrica, and in the Hall of Names, I found my birth certificate. Now, that wasn't easy either, because when I came in, and I had hired a Polish guide to take me from Warsaw to Pietrica, and she in turn hired a guide from Pietrica, because she didn't know her way around there, and I had a driver, so I had these three Polish people helping me out, and we went into the Hall of Records, And she said, I would, the secretary that said I would have to give her my passport. So I said, well, you can have my American passport, but the name that I'm looking for is different. The age is different. The birthday might be different. And the place of origin is different, because I had this German city that I was born in rather than Pietrzykow. And here I'm looking in Pietrzykow. So what are you looking for if you're not looking for that? So you have to give a little bit of explanation, but it's really hard for somebody who's not into it to explain it. Anyway, my interpreters, my guides explained it, and she said she would look. And then we went on to see if in the other hall of records, whether maybe my parents had an apartment registered. We did not find that. So I don't know whether they weren't registered or whether they didn't own an apartment. They may have been renting. I mean, they were young. As a matter of fact, well, I'll tell you about young afterwards. But then we went on to my apartment. And we found my apartment with a balcony that I remembered, with a kiosk that I remembered. As I said, I don't know why it's so important, but they were there. And on the door, there was a mezuzah. And I said, you know, even if it's not my apartment, it's a Jewish apartment, because this mezuzah is a Jewish symbol. And we knocked at the door, and I was afraid that this woman would not let us in, because I had heard stories. And I had told the guide that I was a very rich American. And I told her this not to impress her, but I wanted her to know that I didn't want that apartment back. I didn't come to claim that. And if the woman had anything from before the war, I could pay a lot of money for it. By the way, 1989 was before the Polish Revolution, so everything was very cheap at the time. I'll tell you how much I paid for my birth certificate. But I tried to put this across so that they would want to give me things or to sell me things that may have belonged to my family. The woman did let us in, and the woman did remember my family. She remembered his mother and father and the three children, and she had worked. My father was a tailor, and she had worked with him, or her mother had worked with him, and she was there also. She must be a woman close to 70, I said. This was in 89, that was 7 years ago. I'm just guessing at that, because I never asked her age, but that's what she looked like. And I asked her if she had anything from before the war, and she said when she moved into the apartment, there had been another woman there. She said she was a very stupid Polish woman. These were her words. And she said she even came in and burned some green bills. They may have been dollars or something like that, but she says there was a fire thing, and she got rid of everything that she didn't want around the house. So she claims that there was nothing there. Never dawned on me to ask her about the furniture, where they belonged, but I wouldn't be able to take that anyway. And what I was very upset about is that after, when I saw the mezuzah on the door, I took pictures of that. And when we got back home, I said, why didn't I ask her if I could take that off? When somebody else was going back, I had asked if they would go, and they claim that they had changed the door sills around. And it had been an old house, and it was taken off. Whether it's so or not, I don't know. But she didn't have anything, except that we took pictures.
It's amazing that survived, really, isn't it, a mezuzah during the war?
The Jewish homes, Pietrzykow was not bombed. Maybe that's why I didn't hear bombs, come to think of it. Warsaw was completely bombed. Pietrzykow was not, so the houses are there. The synagogue is still there. It's a library. The place that we were rounded up, it's a library. But Rabbi Lau, who had gone back, and he goes back as a dignitary because he's chief rabbi, he told me what to look for. And he said, if you ask the librarian to pull open a curtain in a small room off from the side of the synagogue, because the synagogue, it was a very big place, that's probably, and there's a smaller place, that you can still see the Aron Kodesh, which is like a closet where the Sefer Torah, the scrolls were put in. And it's all bullet riddled, and I have pictures of that. So I asked the librarian, and outside of this library, which had been repaired after the war, because it did sustain some damage, there are lanterns, light lanterns, and they're in the shape of a Jewish star, and they're still there to this day. Now, Now, as far as the mezuzah on the doors, they're very small. And if you just paint it over, it's like a crack in the wall. You don't think about it. But I was so interested in looking at it because it proved to me. There's also, I have a picture of it, and I didn't know what it meant until I went back to Poland the second time, where on the outside, it has this PGN.
A little notice, yes.
A little notice, and the address. And the reason I know the address of the house, again, not because I remembered it, but on my DP card, it said that that was the last place of residence. And this PGN means that it was owned by Jewish people. Now, maybe it was more than just a house. One of the things which...